and welcome to Keep Calm and Choir On, a podcast about the power of singing together. My name is Ryan LaBoy, and our guest this afternoon is the award-winning American soprano Felicia Moore. Felicia is recognized as a powerful and innovative emerging artist and has sung under the baton of esteemed conductors like Alan Gilbert, Yannick Nézet-Séguin, Speranza Scappucci, and Brian Zeger, and is frequently invited to perform as the soprano soloist for works such as Verdi's Requiem, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, and Mahler's Second Symphony, with top orchestras like the National Arts Center Orchestra, San Diego Symphony, and the Danish National Symphony Orchestra. This season, some performance highlights for Felicia include joining the roster of the Metropolitan Opera in Mozart's The Magic Flute, and singing the role of Susan B. Anthony in Virgil Thompson and Gertrude Stein's The Mother of Us All at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Felicia studied at the Juilliard School, Manus School of Music, and Westminster Choir College, and is currently living in New York City. Felicia, thank you so much for joining us today, and welcome.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah, I can't believe that we're actually doing this. It's been a literal decade since we've hung out.
That is actually crazy. That is crazy to me that that's possible, but yes.
So, Felicia, you are quite an accomplished singer, and we can read that from visiting your website or from the extended bio that you gave me and my students to read about you to generate the interview questions that we are going to ask you today. But I'm wondering, before we jump into that, how you doing?
Yeah, it's a rough time. I'm in New Jersey with my family, and I'm definitely lucky to be here. I'm lucky that we're all safe and healthy. But I should actually be in Arizona right now, performing Ariadne auf Naxos. It was supposed to be my first Strauss role. And after that, I was supposed to do my first Verdi role, and things are just slowly canceling one after the other. And it's very hard, but ultimately, like, that doesn't matter nearly as much as protecting and making sure that people are healthy right now and just staying home. So it's doing my job as a citizen in an entirely different way right now.
Yeah, I'm glad that you can put that positive spin on it, because you just going to your website and looking at all of the things that you have lined up for this season and beyond, it's so impressive and so exciting, and I would imagine so incredibly disheartening that, for example, with Arizona, you've already put in so much work to prepare for that role, your first Strauss role, as you were saying, and now you're yeah. sitting in your family's house in Princeton, New Jersey, which is lovely, I'm sure.
Lovely, but not the same as working. No, I think I mentioned in like the extended bio that I sent you something about how long it takes for big voices to cook. Mm-hmm. And I'm at that age now where, like, I'm cooked and I am ready. And it's just not very often that people do this bigger rep. So I don't know when I'll get another chance to really do it. It might be a little while, and it's going to take a while for companies to even recover from this huge loss, sure. which is what this is. So it's kind of scary.
Yeah, it's super scary. Well, Felicia, if I can provide just a little bit of comfort
Please
for
do,
you
yes.
from having read through all of your information, you are well booked, including what will hopefully be your Metropolitan debut next year in Verdi's Nabucco.
Yeah, I very much hope that happens.
Well, Felicia, let's jump in a little bit and talk about some of your early life information that you provided us. Let's start with a question from my student, Aaron, who asks, can you go into more detail about your early years and what it was like to have a rock and roll family? What kind of influence does that have on you now that you're pursuing a, quote, similar, not the same path?
So my parents don't really like or listen to classical music or opera at all. I grew up in a household that was playing rock and roll and blues and jazz. I mean, I grew up like purely on Zeppelin and Etta James and Bob Dylan. So yeah, they were definitely very shocked when I said I wanted to follow this classical music passion that I have no idea where that came from. It didn't come from this house. But I think the really great thing about that is that genres are kind of mushed in my brain. Like mm-hmm. when I listen to Strauss, it can sound like metal to me, or like Mozart can sound super jazzy to me. Mm. And I feel like it's a real gift that I don't genres don't really matter to me as much as just performing it honestly. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I got from this house, which is nice.
In your bio, you talk quite beautifully about how in high school you were a choir nerd.
Yeah.
And you thought that everybody loved choir, and that is in part what inspired you to go to Westminster Choir College. Can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, I teach college-age students, mm-hmm. And so they're trying to figure out who they are and determine what their paths are, and they have their own questions and doubts the same ways that we did. So how did you decide to make that transition from choir and singing as a hobby to choir and singing as a potential career path?
I just knew in high school that nobody else seemed to love choir like I did. And that's, I was like, okay, this is clearly something else. This is not like a normal hobby. This is a passion that I should actually try to follow. And because I went to high school in Princeton, and Westminster's in Princeton, so they have a conservatory for high school students. So I studied there in high school. And then my teacher there knew a voice teacher at Westminster, and I had some voice lessons with her and realized that we really clicked, and that was maybe a good transition for me to try to stay in choir, but try to figure out whether solo singing was something I wanted to pursue or not, but still have that comfort of, I'm still in choir though, the place that I like need and want to be and feel comfortable.
Yeah, safety in numbers.
Yes, always.
Singing requires an incredible amount of vulnerability that I don't know that many people are conscious of or that enough people give us credit for, but mm-hmm. it's just you and your body.
Yep.
You know, and anything
in front of everyone.
In front of everyone. I mean, like, you might as well be naked on a stage. Like, yeah. Whatever goes wrong, if you're out of tune or if you come in at a wrong time, whatever the case might be, if you're an instrumentalist, and I love instrumentalists, but if you're an instrumentalist, you can say, oh, this damn trumpet.
Yeah.
You know, or something like that. Or, oh, the key got jammed on the piano.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
As a singer.
You're like, ooh, this. Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't like, say anything about, oh, wow, it's me.
I guess that I'm in the middle of puberty. And that happened.
That happened right here in public.
Yeah, in public for everyone, or, you know, in a more tender and kind of serious way, like, man, why am I not good enough?
Yeah.
Did you have feelings like that when you were in undergrad, Felicia?
Yeah, it was very hard because I was trying to figure out whether I even wanted or could do solo singing. And mm-hmm. at the same time was having a teacher who was telling me, you can't, when I just didn't even know yet. It makes me so mad. It makes me so mad that teachers do that. I had somebody recently ask me, you know, do you want to teach? I'm like, no, in no universe do I want to have that responsibility because it's gone wrong too many times for me. I'm lucky to have a really great teacher now, but yeah, it's hard to find the right one for you.
Yeah. And as a choir director and a teacher, I think what I would say to that is I sort of think of my role similarly in the responsibility that I bear. And I remind mm-hmm. myself of the Hippocratic Oath, which is first do no harm.
Yes.
Right? Because you're dealing with real people in real time who are coming from real lives. And yep. you just don't know what is contributing to their, beyond like the vocal pedagogy you've been taught, you don't know what's contributing to what's happening in their world right now.
Totally.
And you know, at the end of the day, it's just singing.
Oh my gosh, I say this all the time. I love singing. I want to do it till I die. But at the end of the day, like when I screw up on stage, because it happens all the time, no one died from that. No one died. Nobody got hurt. I felt a little embarrassed and we moved on. It's not a big deal. At least for me in undergrad and like all the undergrads that I remember when we were at Westminster, like you're kind of supposed to not be amazing for a while. It's something I feel like people, particularly at Juilliard, didn't really understand because you're like right next to Lincoln Center, right next to the Met, the dream place. Yeah. But you're like 18, 19, like you're just not going to be amazing. And that's part of that process and that journey.
Well, so I want to talk a little bit about your voice teacher scenario. And I know that this may still be a little tender for you, but I also know that you've sort of found a way to use this as fuel for your passion and part of the reason you do what you do. And so I have a really great question from my student Chiname, who says, emotional trauma can be damaging to your mental health. During those times of mental abuse from your teacher, what were some coping methods you used to keep moving forward?
Honestly, it was choir. I mean, this was pretty much the first 2 years at Westminster where I was experiencing this. And it was my third year that I decided to switch teachers. But yeah, because of that safety in numbers, which is what you're talking about, I felt that safety net where I could really trust myself in music again and in singing. And I knew that I was like lovingly surrounded by all of my colleagues and that nobody was going to scream at me. Nobody was going to say anything bad. And I could just explore that love again and feel safe again in that.
Oh my gosh. I have like almost the exact same experience. And no, not all of us at Westminster Choir College have the same experience, but it is a unique place because it's a vocal conservatory. It's all singing all the time. Mm. But after my freshman year, my voice teacher left Westminster. They went on to a different teaching position. So then I had to find a new teacher. Fine, I found a new teacher. But in that second year of study, that teacher was a good teacher. And they've since passed, so I don't want to speak poorly of them. That teacher was a good teacher. I recognized even then that teacher was not the teacher for me.
Yeah.
Right. And there is a difference. Not a good teacher is not a good teacher is a good teacher. Right. Mm-hmm. And so there is a right fit for everyone in terms of vocal learning. And this teacher was not the person for me, but by the end of my second year, I was like, man, maybe I should be an English major. Maybe whole singing thing is not for me because this voice teacher really thinks that my voice wants to do one thing. And I'm telling you, based on what I feel in my body, it does not want to do this thing. And I know that I'm young. And Felicia, you've talked about how the voice takes time to cook. I get that. And also, I know my body.
Yes.
And so end of my junior year, I also switched teachers. And my junior and senior year were amazing. And I am going to say, shout out to Amy Zorn. I love you. You changed my life. You brought me back. And you just gave me permission to be a singer, period. And that I didn't need to fit into any sort of box to make that happen. I was so thankful for making that switch. And it sounds like that's a similar story to what happened to you, Felicia.
Yeah, I needed somebody who wasn't going to fill my head with those negative thoughts every single week. Mm-hmm. It was so constant. It was so hard to break away from that when I did move on to another teacher, I pretty much like cried every lesson because it was so healing. It was such a relief to just sing and not be afraid of that. Oh my gosh. Yes. It was incredible.
Another simple but really good question from one of my students after reading your resume comes from Aubrey, and she asks, how did you afford going to great schools as a starting musician? You talked before about how your parents were worried that you essentially chose a career path where you weren't going to make any money, and yet we're talking about three really big name schools, Westminster Choir College, the Manus School of Music, and the Juilliard School. How did you make that work?
Well, I'm certainly dealing with a lot of student loan debt now. Mm-hmm. And my parents also have a bit of debt from the schools. But I was lucky that they were able and willing to help me out a bit financially, particularly with rent once I moved to New York City. Because it wasn't until really a couple of years ago that I started making decent money to actually live completely on my own.
Yeah, your voice needed to cook.
Yes, that cooking, it takes a while. But it's also why I started doing a lot of competitions was because I know that that is fast money if you're able to do that and be successful with those. But yeah, it's not easy. It's very expensive and it's really hard to start out as a singer if you don't come from some amount of money, to be totally frank and honest about it, because you're just not going to be able to support yourself entirely on your own.
Yeah, and that's sort of a harsh reality to the world that we live in. And in my context at a community college, I try to be so careful about how I talk to our students about that because we're already working in a context where they might not have enough resources.
Totally.
So I definitely feel that. And as a kid who grew up, I mean, frankly, I own my story. You know, I grew up in a trailer park with a single mother. How I got through Westminster Choir College was I worked my butt off. And I don't know if you remember, but I was super involved in student government.
Yeah, you were.
Mm-hmm. Right? And so I was the SGA president for a couple of years. And that at our college came with a half tuition remission. I was only responsible for paying 50% of what tuition for this private college would have cost. And then on top of that, we had all of our FAFSA funding and my parents both were chipping in a little bit. But ultimately, similar to you, the bulk of that financial responsibility is on me, and my student loans are almost paid off.
It's like, yay! Yeah. Oh my gosh, that's
so
amazing.
Close.
I'll never
so
see
close.
That light of day, but I'm so happy for you.
You know, you talked about your financial situation being the reason that you started participating in competitions. And I have a question from a student, particularly about competitions. This comes from Marie, and she asks, given the impressive list of awards that you've won, how does one even begin to enter competitions like that?
I just kind of went for it. I didn't really ask anyone, which probably wasn't a great move, to be honest. I was living in New York. I was going to Manas, and I really didn't want to be stuck in some sort of bubble within Manas, which a lot of the conservatory, all of conservatories are, but especially in New York. Whatever I got at Manas that year in terms of casting and performance opportunities, it doesn't matter when I graduate. I have to move on to something else. And those competitions lead to connections, I mean, of course, as well as money. I just sort of went for it and just started. And it was a very strange path for me, competitions, because I weirdly won a pretty great one, like off the bat. And then it kind of messed with my head. Like, I was like, wow, I'm great, I guess. And yeah. I'm just going to keep winning stuff, probably. It's not how it works at all.
Talk a little bit about that. So you experience lots of success right away when you enter competitions, or at least a pretty significant success. And then what happened?
So that was with the George London competition. I won that. And the same weekend was the Metropolitan Opera National Council auditions. And I was in the semifinals, and I didn't make it to the finals. And I was like little baby dramatic soprano, totally heartbroken about this, thinking I just ruined my career. Like, I completely messed that up. I'm not going to get anything after that. Nobody liked me in that competition. And I was on the Met stage, so I'll never be back here, I guess. Like, your mind just floods into all of these things. None of them are true.
Yeah.
None of them are true. And it's hard. It was very hard for me to bounce back from that. But it just took doing more competitions and basically practicing how to let go of those negative thoughts and realizing, like, no, thank you. That's not helpful right now. I don't need to hear that right now. And you teach yourself how to not dig into that. So I think a lot of your students asked about being nervous and getting over those kind of first jitters when you first start singing. Mm-hmm. It is literally just about being scared anyway and doing it.
Yeah.
I'm always slightly nervous, slightly on edge about it, but it's just about doing it anyway.
But I would imagine that also adds a certain spark to performance.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah, that adrenaline totally comes from that. And also the high that you feel after, because you're like, I did that.
I conquered my fears.
It's huge.
So I have a sort of a silly question, but I do love it. A student of mine, Avery, asks, what would you say was your favorite college to attend out of the three schools you attended? Westminster Choir College, Manus School of Music, and the Juilliard School. And why might that be? And maybe rather than choosing one favorite, maybe you can talk to us a little bit about some of the key lessons you learned from each of those places that you still carry with you today.
Ooh, okay. Yeah, because it's hard to pick a favorite. I do feel like
I mean, it's learned... Westminster Choir College, obviously.
I mean, obviously that was it. But I learned so much about myself from each of those places. And I was at such a different place in my life that they were all super valid. Mm-hmm. I guess, I mean, Westminster Choir College was really, I mean, that key time, like 18 to 22, where you're trying to figure out, like, what is this path? What does this look like? And as much as I don't like that teacher, that was really...
But that was one teacher out of a whole bunch of teachers that you learned from.
It totally was, but it also informed how I was going to interact with all other teachers after that. And it taught me a lot about being resilient and about not letting somebody else ever tell me what I already know about myself. They don't get to tell me that.
Oh, I love that. Because yeah, regardless of their reputation or their ego or their acclaim, you are the expert on you.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, it was so frustrating because I really thought that was just what all singers had to go through. And it wasn't until I talked to my pianist in my lessons and he was like, nope, that is not how this is supposed to work. You are the ones calling the shot here. You are the one paying to go here.
Hello.
Like, it is completely up to you. This is your education. And if you don't like it, leave.
So, talk a little bit about Manus. What I don't, this is actually where our paths diverge, and I don't
Yes.
know, school-wise, what has happened. So, what was so influential or important about your education at Manus?
My real love of opera started, I would say, at Manos. I was in my first, well, it was my second show, The Rape of Lucretia by Benjamin Britten. And that was intense, as you can imagine by the title. Very intense opera to be a part of. And before this, I had kind of thought of opera as being kind of fluffy and not very serious. Like, I wouldn't learn a lot about human behavior and humankind through opera. And this opera completely changed my mind about that. I felt this huge weight of responsibility. That role was really just heavy. And it also taught me a lot about not taking my work home with me, because I can't remember a
Interesting.
time when I was more depressed than when we did that show, because I didn't know how to just, okay, rehearsal's done. Stop. Go home. Don't take this home because you're not going to sleep. I didn't know how to do that yet. So that was really something I had to learn, because there's a lot of operas are like that, where it's hard to let it go.
So, can you talk to us a little bit about the Juilliard School and what you feel the value of that education was?
Yeah, so I did not think I was going to go back to school. I started at Juilliard at 28, but I knew that acting was the weakest part of my performing, and I know that their acting program is incredible. So I was really able to use all of those performing opportunities that I got there and all of those audition opportunities to my fullest advantage.
So my student Avery also asks, based on your experience at the Juilliard School, do you think it's fair that your opinions and talents were much more respected after you attended Juilliard? Why don't you think they were considered, quote unquote, worthy before?
I mean, it's not fair. It's not at all fair. Like, it is frustrating. But it does make a difference. And nobody's outright said to me, like, I respect you more and I'm more willing to hire you because of this. But it's just a sense that I've gotten from people. And it's, like you said, like, I mean, I subconsciously do it all the time, particularly with like other competitions where I'm like, ooh, they won that big shiny one. That must mean that they're amazing. And yeah, of course they're good, but like it's all so subjective to who was judging that day, who happens to teach at that school, and that's why they're there. Yeah, it's all just so subjective that I personally don't really think it should matter. It should really be about whatever that person's talent and it basically is in the audition. It really shouldn't be colored by all of those other things. But I think sadly it just is.
And I know that's something you're particularly passionate about. Is there anything that you'd like to say about access and privilege and
It really is such a huge problem, and particularly in opera, it's something that is being discussed way more, thank God, about the lack of diversity that we see on stage. And even like particularly I would say in young artist programs, you tend to look at them and you're like, these are all white kids. They're all white kids. So why would anybody who's not white look up to that and say, I could do that? Like, where is the proof of that? I mean, I do think it's changing, but I think it's changing very slowly. But I am thrilled that people are at least talking about it.
These are massive institutions with hundreds of years of legacy. And so it's like turning this huge ship. And it's like in our time, the rudder is very small, right? And we in our time understand, oh, the boat needs to turn. But turning the rudder really quickly still means the boat is going to turn
Real
super
slow.
slowly. And nobody's going to be satisfied with how quickly that is changing. And I know that you felt that particularly in your experience recently performing Susan B. Anthony at the Met Museum, different than the Met Opera. So you performed Susan B. Anthony at the Metropolitan Museum, and there were some comments made about your body and the fact that you didn't look like Susan B. Anthony. And maybe now is a good time to discuss some of that. What were those comments, and how did that make you feel, and how did you respond?
I got to perform Susan B. Anthony, which was amazing, but I was incredibly nervous about it because I know that I don't look like her, and I know how cruel people can be about that. And for some reason, that matters. I'll never know. I mean, she was not an opera singer. So, but yeah, so I was really concerned, particularly leading up to the show, that all of the reviews were going to mention that. And amazingly enough, none of them mentioned that actually. So last week, the Met Museum actually streamed the show on their Facebook and YouTube pages. Mm-hmm. And there was some comment from some woman that I don't know at all, saying that this was blasphemy because Susan B. Anthony wasn't fat. And I was just so mad because I had been kind of waiting for that comment for ages. And it comes like a month and a half after the show.
Yeah.
from somebody I don't know who isn't important in my life. And yet it still pisses me off. Yeah. It will always make me so angry when something like this happens. Mm-hmm. And I'm not like hurt by it, but I'm just mad that that is even something that we are discussing. She basically looked at me from this little promo video and assumed that I was not capable of doing my job in that role. Hmm. In what universe do you think that that's okay? And in what universe do you think it's okay to publicly shame me about it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It happens a lot, I have to say, whether it be from the public or from casting directors or voice teachers, which has happened a lot with me with voice teachers, or coaches who think that they're being very helpful, saying that I just got to lose weight if I want to be believable on stage. And I don't know what they mean. I'm like, believable. I'm on stage. Believe me. I'm there.
Hello. So. Thank you. Yes.
So I'm there. And what they simply mean is that I'm not believable as somebody who is a confident woman who's probably in love on stage in that role that I'm portraying. Mm. And so it goes back, you know, to diversity on stage in terms of representation. And I know, at least when I'm in the audience, I love looking on the stage and seeing fat singers up there because I know that I can relate so much more to that immediately. Mm-hmm. I don't have to filter through like, maybe that could be me. You know, there's just an immediacy that happens with that.
Yeah. And so often when we think about diversity and representation on stage, we think about it only in terms of race. And what I want to say, that is important. That's very important for
absolutely.
Us to consider.
Yes.
And
yes.
Also, diversity is diverse. Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. And so it can, you know, in your position, Felicia, it also is a matter of body positivity and singers of all shapes and sizes being up on that stage. And yeah, being a confident, sexy woman, singing Carmen and having a few extra pounds.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, and being thick and beautiful.
I don't see how all of those are true. Like you can be fat and all of those things at the same time. And it's why I use the word fat a lot. I don't use like bigger or big boned or whatever the other words are. Yes, all of those things. Because historically, fat has been used to also say, you know, that they're lazy and that maybe they're ugly and maybe they're not disciplined. And it's not any of those things. Mm-hmm. Fat just means you take up more space than someone who's not fat. That's all it has to do with.
I love that.
That's it.
Yeah.
Oh, so I love using that word, and I especially love using it around people who are not used to hearing it. So I can like feel immediately that discomfort of like, should I say it also? Is it okay? And I'm like, yes, it's fine. Go for it.
Well, and I mean, I'll own my stuff in this too. When you first sent along your extended biography for my students, you used the word fat, and I went to go correct it to say something that I thought was a little more politically correct. And then somehow in my years, I've gained a little bit of wisdom. I paused and I said, let me just call her and ask. And so, you know, but it was important for me as somebody on the outside of that conversation to get permission to speak of it that way.
Totally.
You know,
and
because,
I totally get that.
Because I think many of us are concerned with being, we actually want to be respectful, right?
Yeah.
And maybe in an extreme sense, politically correct.
Sure.
But I think, gosh, I just love that you are wanting to start this fat revolution and just like reclaim the word. You're like the Lizzo of opera.
Oh my God, I will take that.
I'm claiming it. You can put it on your website. Lizzo, if you're listening, we love you.
We love you. Come on the pod.
So I do have another question for those of us who are not killing it and on top of the world in the performing arts. My student Brittany asks, as someone who might not have the ability to have a public face, how can we also be advocates for diversity on stage?
Yeah, I think it's important to be very vocal about the artists that you enjoy and want to see on your stages. Mm-hmm. A lot of companies will send out like a survey afterwards asking for how you enjoyed the show. And it's super important to to fill those out and to mention that if that really matters to you, and it should. And also to like make sure that you're following those artists' social media pages, making sure that you're seeing them live when you can, because that essentially tells whoever is in charge of casting that that is who the audience wants to see on their stage.
Knowing that you went to a place for your undergraduate degree where choir was the middle name of the institution, several of my students have questions about how choir influenced you, inspired you, and led to your sort of breakout as a solo performer. And so my first question comes from my student named Bin. He asks, what are the aspects of singing in choir that made you love ensemble singing so much more than solo singing in your undergraduate years?
It's really hard for me to describe what I love so much about choral singing, because it literally feels like magic, and like no words are actually enough for it ever. But there's something about... I know, it's hard, yeah.
It's a podcast, you have to find the words.
I know. Well, there's something about it that makes you feel so vast, like doing the same thing as that amount of, that group of people, where you just feel like you can do anything, like... like, how could wars ever have happened? Look at what community can do.
We sang in the Westminster Choir with Dr. Miller. And I'm wondering, do you have any takeaways from that particular experience? That more, I mean, we were 40 voices, so it's incorrect to call it a chamber choir experience. But compared to symphonic singing, in that more
it chamber
experience. Chamber,
yeah.
So what, as a dramatic soprano, even then, what was that experience like for you? And how did it shape the musician you became?
Yeah, I feel like I really honed my listening skills in Westminster Choir. Being like in the middle of the choir like that, you have to be able to hear everyone else and adjust tuning and things like that. And it's just listening in an entirely different way than what I had ever done before, which I feel like has really helped my opera singing and my acting. And it really drives me crazy when opera singers like bash choir or like hate on their time in choir when they were younger. And I'm like, why? You're good at this now because of that. Like, it's all about listening. Yeah. Like opera, you know, we all always just practice our arias, but, and that's all people usually talk about, but most of it is ensemble singing. Trios, duets, all that jazz.
Well, and even when you're singing a solo, you're singing
you
with an orchestra
never
and a conductor.
Alone. Ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. And acting is all about listening, because acting is about reacting. And I can't react to anything if I've not bothered to listen to what you're saying.
I have a question off of this that a student of mine, Sophia, asks. And she says, do you still feel the same sense of community in opera compared to choir?
It depends on the cast. It depends on the conductor, the director. It depends on so many things. I have and can. I particularly felt that when I did Dialogues of the Carmelites at St. Louis. I really, that was such an incredible piece to be a part of. And because it's about being in a convent, you immediately feel that sort of community within that isolation. So yeah, it is possible. And I do feel it sometimes, but it just depends a lot about who's in that room with you.
Yeah, and whether or not they sang in choir, for Pete's
sake. Absolutely. You can tell right away.
So we've been talking about it, so we might as well dig in now to some yummy Gustav Mahler. Just to give a little bit of history for people listening out there who might not know much about Gustav Mahler or about this piece. Gustav Mahler was a late Romantic composer, born in 1860 and died in 1911 in what is now the Czech Republic. Studied at the Vienna Conservatory, and even in his student days was attracted to Wagner opera. And though he never composed opera, you can totally hear the scale of drama borrowed from opera in his symphonic works.
Yep.
Yeah, not an opera composer, but often conducted opera and was a very well-renowned opera conductor in his day, and conducted all over Europe in cities like Prague and Leipzig and Budapest and Hamburg and Vienna, and then moved to the U.S. in the early 1900s to conduct at the Metropolitan Opera, and then soon became the music director of the New York Philharmonic. His second symphony, called the Resurrection Symphony, and it's a follow-up to his first symphony, where he tells this narrative arc throughout the entire symphony of this hero character. And the piece actually opens with this movement called Totenfeier, which means funeral rite in English. And so when the second symphony starts, we are immediately at the funeral of the hero character from his first symphony. From there, the piece is divided into four other movements. So there's five movements total in Mahler's second symphony. There's an andante, a scherzo, the fourth movement, which is the Urlicht, which translates to primal light for mezzo-soprano, which is just like...
divine. It is, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the fifth movement of the symphony is longer than any of the other combined parts of the symphony. It's over 30 minutes long, mm-hmm. and it is just absolutely astounding. This was known as Mahler's personal favorite work, and he conducted it as his farewell concert in Vienna, Austria, and it was also his breakout performance in both New York City and Paris. And I just want to read a little bit from the book Choral Repertoire by Dennis Schrock that I bought in my graduate studies, and because I just need to read through how big this piece is. So these are the forces it takes to perform this piece. Symphony number 2, the Resurrection Symphony, calls for soprano alto soloist, a full Debussy chorus, so double soprano, double alto, double tenor, double bass, and orchestra, which includes 4 flutes, 4 piccolos, 4 oboes, 2 English horns, 5 clarinets, bass clarinet, 4 bassoons, contrabassoon, 10 French horns, 6 trumpets, 4 trombones, a tuba, 2 sets of timpani, a bass drum, 2 military drums, a triangle, cymbals, tam-tam, ruth, 2 harps, and an organ. And then it goes on to say that Mahler additionally calls for an offstage ensemble of 4 French horns, 4 trumpets, timpani, bass drum, cymbal, and triangle. I mean, my
real
God, it is an enormous, shout out to Dennis Schrock. Thank you for giving us this treasure trove of choral repertoire. Like, how do you even compose a piece of music like that?
Yeah, it's huge. It's a huge piece.
Yeah, and then just hearing me ramble through that list that included everything but the kitchen sink, you can imagine how we as 20, 21-year-olds singing this piece as juniors in college were just
minds blown.
Yeah, so talk about your experience a little bit, Felicia. I talked about mine already. How did you feel when we were first doing all of this?
Yeah, I was very green at the time. Like, I didn't really know many symphonic pieces, so I had no idea what I was in for when we first did this piece.
None of us did.
None of us did. It was, yeah. So yeah, I feel like my mind just like blew open in terms of what other kind of performing was possible. Like, I knew that opera was a thing. I knew recital singing was a thing. I didn't know about symphonic works from a soloist perspective. So when the mezzo started, I was like, that is heaven speaking, I think, like right now. I had no idea that that kind of strength, but through that kind of stillness, was possible with one person. I had felt it in a choir, but to feel it funneled through just a single person, it's kind of like, it was such a game changer for me. It really was.
Yeah, and I remember in reading some of the material you sent along to us too, I remember reading exactly that you said it was a game changer for you, mm-hmm. And that it was sort of this bridging of worlds for you too, because it was a soloist doing their thing within the comfort zone of still having a choir there.
Totally, yep. Yeah, and that's still, I love opera and I always want to do it, but I really love doing concert work. I really love that. That feels much more like home base for me.
All right, so let's listen into a recording of Mahler's Second Symphony. This recording, also iconic because it features Leonard Bernstein conducting, Christa Ludwig singing the mezzo-soprano role, Barbara Hendricks singing the soprano role, and legacy here, the Westminster Symphonic Choir.
Woo! <It's>, yes!
Like, this is our legacy, Felicia.
Yeah, the legacy is real.
We are part of this lineage.
Yeah.
I'm going to piece together for you, our listeners, a few different movements from the piece. So you'll hear a little bit of the Urlicht, the mezzo-soprano solo that we were talking about, sung by Christa Ludwig. And then we'll transition into the fifth and final movement, the Auferstehen, where we'll hear a little bit of the choral entrance that's very soft and from afar, hymn-like. And then we'll skip ahead a lot because there's a lot of music that happens to just the sheer awesome moment of this piece where the roof just blows off the whole thing and you are just shot out into the universe. It's absolutely incredible. So let's listen in. To spend a little bit of time for my singers who don't know much about this necessarily, talking specifically about opera, which is sort of your wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing that we want to know is, because this came up in your bio, you mentioned that you were training as a Wagnerian soprano.
Mm-hmm.
Kimberly asks, what is a Wagnerian singer?
Can you
give us a quick and dirty rundown of what that means?
Sure. So Wagnerian singers are singers who typically sing those very long operas by Wagner, which typically means that we have larger voices. Our vocal folds are typically thicker, and the stamina that is required is a lot. These are long shows, like 5.5 hours. It is like running a marathon. So it's a very different kind of singing, I would say.
Oh, nice. I love that analogy of running a marathon compared to like a 10K or a 5K.
There's no sprinting here. It's an
Yeah,
all-day
but
thing.
you know what? But they're all Olympic sports.
Yes, absolutely.
Totally. So then, because a few students asked this, and I'll just kind of compile their thoughts together.
Sure.
How did you know you had a bigger voice that could do something like Wagner? And the question arose around, were you born with that gift, or is it something that you
It
trained?
mostly came from teachers saying, I think that might be the path for you based on the way that my bone structure is. Because I really do think you're born with it. I don't really think that you can manipulate it into something else. Like your bone structure is what it is. You have the rib cage, you have the high cheekbones, you have whatever it
Yeah,
is.
I think of Birgit Nielsen, like those
Oh my
cheeks
God,
could
huge.
kill.
Yeah. And her head was massive. I'm like, no neck. You usually don't have a neck, really. It's just a column of sound.
Amazing. It's like if you look like Uncle Fester, you are
Probably
a
gonna do
Wagnerian
that,
singer.
That's the rule we go by, actually. Yeah.
It's a rule of thumb.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's kind of how that happened.
So when you started to make that transition into soloistic operatic singing, my student Ben asks, who was one of your role models that you looked up to make that transition? Or maybe there's a handful of singers you could recommend to us, Felicia.
Yeah, so Birgit Nielsen was who you mentioned, was definitely somebody who I listened to a lot, and Kirsten Flagstad, because they both sing what I hopefully will eventually be singing in those bigger roles. But one singer that if I am looking for a recording of something and she's got one, I'm gonna listen to it. And that is Leontine Price. Her it's pristine. Like her voice is it's perfect. I don't really have any other words besides it's just perfect singing. And then, yeah, so Leontine Price. And then another singer who I really love is Eileen Farrell, who also had a really great jazz career as well as opera,
Oh, interesting.
which totally le links back to what I was talking about growing up, where, and you can hear it in her singing, like her recording of Barbara's Knoxville, summer of 1915. I didn't know that English could sound luscious until I listened to her singing that. I mean, it's such a treat. Like, treat yourself, go listen.
I will. I
Yeah.
definitely will. So another sort of Opera 101 question, that I have from a student, which I adore this question. I think it's great. It comes from, again, Aubrey. And she asks, how do you handle getting a role you don't want?
Yeah.
Or let's add on to that too. How do you handle if you auditioned for something and you were hoping for a part and you got cast in the chorus?
First of all, just like I think it's important to just like let yourself be sad about that for a bit. But then ultimately you're gonna learn something. You're always gonna learn something by being on stage and watching other people doing what they do. I've been in like many opera choruses and other roles that I didn't love or didn't really want to be doing, but any opportunity to be on stage is learning stagecraft. So it's always a good opportunity to learn.
So before we talked a bunch about your recent role portraying Susan B. Anthony, another question coming from a student named Jackie is, what is your favorite opera that you've performed in and why? And then to tag on a second question to that, coming from Bethany, what is your dream role on stage?
Ooh, okay. My favorite opera that I've been a part of is probably Mozart's Don Giovanni, because it's the one that I've done the most. Yeah, I've always played Donna Elvira, and
Yes.
I just love her. I love her. She is so feisty. She is so passionate. She is saying the stuff that is not really okay at the time to be saying. It's really radical stuff. And she's also, pegged for being crazy because she loves a man who is terrible to her and every other person he meets. But who hasn't loved someone that they shouldn't? Who hasn't like regretted that? That is so human and honest. And I love that she like leans into that and isn't really like apologetic about it. She's like, yeah, I love him. I do.
Yeah, and just like super quickly, for those of you who are listening who don't know about Don Giovanni, it's a Mozart opera. Essentially, the title character is this player, and he sort of traipses from woman to woman. And Elvira is one of the women caught in his web.
Yeah. In terms of my dream role, I love Beethoven's Fidelio. It's the only opera that he wrote, and I love it. I know a lot of people don't like it because his vocal writing wasn't always kind, but
yeah, not my fave. I'll be honest. Yeah. I'll just own it.
It's not always great. But I actually love it. And I really love Leonora in the show. I love that she sets out to save her man. He has been secretly imprisoned by this evil nobleman. And she decides to dress up as a man to work at the prison that she knows he is at to go rescue him. And I just think that's so incredible. I think her courage is amazing.
So you've talked a little bit about your favorite opera and your dream role, but I want to talk particularly about one opera that you've been in, because that's where our second excerpt today is going to come from, that is Francis Poulenc's Dialogues of the Carmelites. So talk to us a little bit about that opera. Can you tell us what it's about?
Sure. So it's, an opera by Poulenc. It is in three acts, and it takes place during the French Revolution. It tells the story of Blanche, who decides to seek refuge in a Carmelite convent, deciding that she thinks that her weak temperament is something that can't withstand the violence that is happening throughout the revolution. But she is consistently warned by Mother Marie and the old priors, who are, the head honchos at the convent, that that's not really the point of this convent. It's not to run away from your fear. Yeah, and eventually the convent is actually not a very safe place to be, because officials have decided to shut down all of the religious houses. So they have their final mass. And rather than leaving and escaping the convent, actually all of the nuns and Mother Marie stay there and eventually are sentenced to execution and die via martyrdom. And eventually Sister Blanche comes back and faces her fear and joins the convent, and they all die.
And they all die. It's a very cheery story.
Yeah, very uplifting.
But two things to add to that.
Yeah.
One, it's a true story.
Yes, it is a true story. And they sang as they were going to that guillotine.
I wonder if one of the nuns, while she was waiting in line to be guillotined, was like, this would make a great opera.
Great opera. Let's sing now.
Oh, my goodness. And actually, the excerpt that we're going to listen to today comes from that finale where the nuns are singing as they're waiting in line to be guillotined, to be decapitated for clinging to their faith. And in the last scene, as depicted by Poulenc, they are singing the Salve Regina, which is the Latin Hail Holy Queen. And it's this beautiful, mostly unison chorus. That they sing. And there are a couple really amazing things to listen to in the recording. One is that as the piece goes on, as each nun dies, the texture of the choir gets thinner and thinner until you're left with one solo voice at the end. And then eventually that last singer, is that also Blanche?
That one is Constance.
Mm-hmm. Constance is also persecuted and killed in the middle of a vocal line. And the second thing that is the most stark and fascinating to me is the guillotine.
Yeah.
And how Poulenc literally composes the guillotine into his score.
Yeah.
And in the premiere of this opera at La Scala in Milan in the 1950s, they actually used a real guillotine.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to read a little bit about that to you from an article that I read on the Royal Opera House's website at the Royal Opera House at Covent Garden. The article is by Rachel Beaumont. And she says, "For worst of all is the unpredictable swish, rattle, thud, marked by Poulenc as sore et lourd, dull and heavy, and an actual replica at the La Scala was used in 1957, but most often now it's a sound effect. The guillotine falls at irregular intervals in terrifying contrast to the steadiness of the nuns praying, snatching away individual singers mid-word in Poulenc's carefully stipulated score, heightening the oral and visual impact of this nightmarish addition to the orchestra. The remaining four nuns move quickly through the second verse, aware of their declining numbers, and eventually only one, Constance, the youngest, is left to finish the final line, O clemens, O pia, O dulcis Virgo Maria, O clement, loving, sweet Virgin Mary. And then she loses her head.
Yep.
And then the opera is over.
Yep.
I mean, it happens just like that. So let's listen in. For those of you who are listening that don't necessarily know much about the composer Francis Poulenc, he was a composer in the turn of the 20th century, was born in 1899, but was not composing then. So writing in the early 1900s, died in 1963, tragically of a heart attack, was born into a pretty well-to-do family. And that was something that sort of followed him. And in reading up on Poulenc to prepare for this interview, I was reading some Nick Strimple, and he said that Poulenc's music reflects the seemingly flippant wit and glib, superficial gloss readily associated with wealth.
Ooh, bold.
Sick burn.
Jeez, man. All right.
Brutal. Yeah. So, I don't know if Strimple likes Poulenc, but I appreciated the drama of that statement. Yeah. Poulenc, for people who are music nerds listening in or know a little bit about French composition, was a member of Les Six, which is a school of composers in Paris in the early 1900s. But they're not really a school. They're just a crew of friends hanging out and writing music together. Okay. And they were composing against popular composers like Ravel, Debussy, and Wagner, who we've already talked about when we were listening to Gustav Mahler before. So here you have Gustav Mahler, who adored Wagner and sought to emulate the drama and raw emotion of his operas. And then we have a composer like Poulenc, who was writing against that. So the members of Les Six were bucking against the establishment of French Impressionism and German Romanticism of the late 19th century. And interestingly, he was an openly gay composer and also was intensely Catholic, which I think you can hear in this opera, Dialogue of the Carmelites. He experienced a religious reawakening in 1936 following the death of a dear friend and composer. And so that sort of reawakening would lend itself to the composition of Dialogue of the Carmelites a few years later. I do have a couple reflection questions for you. The first question comes from my student, Davin, and he asks, do you believe that you'd be in the same place you are now if you didn't face the hardships you have head on?
No. I mean, those hardships have completely shaped how I deal with every new hardship that comes up. And I think that's true for everybody. You learn how to be resilient from what you bounce back from.
The second question that we have for our reflections also comes from Davin. And I really like this question. And it is, what would you say to your first teacher or teachers that doubted you? And what advice would you give them to improve on their behavior?
Ooh, yeah, sadly, I do think about this a lot, actually. When somebody treats you like that, they just kind of like live in your head for longer than they should. And I would probably say that she should never underestimate her students and what they're capable of. And that you should never make somebody feel like they are not worthy of your teaching. That was the hardest thing to bounce back from, for sure.
And then the last question that I have for you, Felicia, what is the power of singing together?
Of course, I'm thinking about this a lot right now, being home and not working and missing that connection that I would feel if I was singing with people and working together. I mean, it is such a powerful thing to feel that sense of community, to come together for one goal, for one purpose of beauty or whatever it is. I think we're all really missing that right now. And I just really can't wait for the time when everybody's back in their rooms together working.
Well, Felicia, I know I've taken a lot of your time this afternoon, and I am so thankful for your graciousness and coming back to talk with me after a decade of not hearing from each other. I followed you on Facebook. I see all of the things you're doing. I am in such admiration of you. And again, just a huge thank you for taking some time to talk with me today and to share your love and your knowledge with me and my students.
Oh, thank you. I'm so happy to be here. It was so great to get that phone call from you and to reconnect with you.
Yeah, I had your phone number in my phone still.
Amazing.
And I was like, well, we're going to see if it works. And it did. To learn more about Felicia or hear her incredible singing, you can visit her website, FeliciaMoore.com, or listen to her on SoundCloud at SoundCloud.com/FeliciaLM. Thank you to my choir students at North Hennepin Community College for asking some wonderful interview questions, and a round of applause for my co-producer and editor, Christina Rodel-Sorum. Be sure to tune into her podcast, Art More Lovely, on your preferred podcast platform. If you like what you heard today and are excited to hear more, you can like us and follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/choironpodcast. And of course, listen to our latest episodes at choiron.buzzsprout.com.